You don't take your wife to America, boy. Those American doctors smart like hell, you know. They could do anything.
Or when Mrs. Baku suggested that she should have a blood test at the Caribbean Medical Commission at the end of Arapita Avenue. The parties at Edward's house grew wilder and more extravagant. Hat said, "Every party does have an end, and people have to go home. Edward only making himself more miserable." The parties certainly were not making Edward's wife any happier. She still looked frail and cantankerous. And now we sometimes heard Edward's voice raised in argument with her. It was not the usual sort of man and wife argument we had in the street. Edward sounded exasperated, but anxious to please. Edo said, "I wish any woman I married tried behaving like that. Man, I give she one good beating and make she straight like bamboo." Pat said, "Edward asked for what he get. And the stupid thing is that I believe Edward really loved the woman." Edward would talk to Hat and Eddowes and the other big men when they spoke to him. But when we boys tried talking to him, he had no patience. He would threaten to beat us. And so we left him alone. But whenever Edward passed, Boy, brave and stupid as ever, would say in an American accent, "What's up, Joe?" Edward would stop and look angrily at Boye, and then lunge at him, shouting and swearing. He used to say, "You see the sort of way Trinidad children does behave? What else this boy want but a good cut-ass?" One day, Edward caught Boye and began flogging him. At every stroke, Boye shouted, "No, Edward!" And Edward got madder and madder. Then Hat ran up and said, "Edward, put down that boy this minute, or else it have big trouble in this street. Put him down, I tell you. I ain't afraid of your big arms, you know." The men in the street had to break up the fight. And when Boy was freed, he shouted to Edward, "Why you don't make child yourself and then beat it?" Hat said, "Boy, I going to cut your tail this minute. Errol, go break a good whip for me." It was Edward himself who broke the news. He said, "She leave me." He spoke in a very casual way. Eddowes said, "I sorry too bad, Edward." Hat said, "Edward boy, the things that not to be, don't be." Edward didn't seem to be paying too much attention. So Eddowes went on, "I didn't like she from the first. And I don't think a man should marry a woman who can't make baby." Edward said, "Eddowes, shut your thin little mouth up. And you too, Hat, giving me all this make-up sympathy. I know how sad all you is. All you so sad, all you laughing." Hat said, "But who laughing?" "Look, Edward, go and give anybody else all this temper, you hear? But leave me out. After all, it ain't nothing strange for a man wife to run away. It's like the Calypso invader sing. I was living with my decent and contented wife until the soldiers came and broke up my life. It ain't your fault. It's the Americans' fault." Eddowes said, "You know who she run away with?" Edward said, "You hear me say she run away with anybody?" Eddowes said, "No, you didn't say that. What is what I feel?" Edward said sadly, "Yes, she run away with an American soldier. And I give the man so much of my rum to drink." But after a few days, Edward was running around telling people what had happened and saying, "It's a damn good thing. I don't want a wife that can't make baby." And now nobody made fun of Edward's Americanism. And I think we were all ready to welcome him back to us. But he wasn't really interested. We hardly saw him in the street. When he wasn't working, he was out on some excursion. Hat said, "Is love. He really loves she. He looking for she." In the Calypso by Lord Invader, the singer loses his wife to the Americans, and when he begs her to come back to him, she says, "Invader, I change my mind. I live in with my Yankee soldier." This was exactly what happened to Edward. He came back in a great temper. He was miserable. He said, "I'm leaving Trinidad." Eddowes said, "Where are you going? America?" Edward almost cuffed Eddowes. Hat said, "But how you want to let one woman break up your life so? You behaving as if you was the first man this thing happened to." But Edward didn't listen. At the end of the month, he sold his house and left Trinidad. I think he went to Aruba or Curacao, working with the big Dutch oil company. And some months later, Hat said, "You know what I hear? Edward wife have a baby for she American." 16. Hat. Hat loved to make a mystery of the smallest things. His relationship to Boyi and Errol, for instance. He told strangers they were illegitimate children of his. Sometimes he said he wasn't sure whether they were his at all, and he would spin a fantastic story about some woman both he and Edward lived with at the same time. Sometimes, again, he would make out that they were his sons by an early marriage. And you felt you could cry when you heard Hat tell how the boy's mother had gathered them around her deathbed and made them promise to be good. It took me some time to find out that Boy and Errol were really Hat's nephews. Their mother, who lived up in the bush near Sangre Grande, died soon after her husband died, and the boys came to live with Hat. The boys showed Hat little respect. They never called him uncle, only Hat. And for their part, they didn't mind when Hat said they were illegitimate. They were, in fact, willing to support any story Hat told about their birth. I first got to know Hat when he offered to take me to the cricket at the Oval. I soon found out that he had picked up 11 other boys from 4 or 5 streets around and was taking them as well. We lined up at the ticket office, and Hat counted us loudly. He said, 1 and 12 half. Many people stopped minding their business and looked up. The man selling tickets said, 12 half. Hat looked down at his shoes and said, 12 half. We created a lot of excitement when all 13 of us, Hat at the head, filed around the ground looking for a place to sit. People shouted, "They's all yours, mister." Hat smiled weakly and made people believe it was so. When we sat down, he made a point of counting us loudly again. He said, "I don't want your mother raising hell when I get home saying one missing." It was the last day of the last match between Trinidad and Jamaica. Jerry Gomez and Len Harbin were making a great stand for Trinidad, and when Gomez reached his 150, Hat went crazy and danced up and down shouting, "White people is God, you hear?" A woman selling soft drinks passed in front of us. Hat said, "How you selling this thing you have in the glass in them?" The woman said, 6 cents a glass. Hat said, "I want the wholesale price. I want 13. The woman said, "These children is all yours." Hat said, "What wrong with that?" The woman sold the drinks at 5 cents a glass. When Len Harbin was 89, he was out LBW, and Trinidad declared. Hat was angry. LBW? LBW? How LBW? Is only a lot of robbery. And is a Trinidad umpire too? God, even umpires take and bribe now. Hat taught me many things that afternoon. From the way he pronounced them, I learned about the beauty of cricketers' names, and he gave me all his own excitement at watching a cricket match. I asked him to explain the scoreboard. He said, "On the left-hand side, they have the names of the batsmen who finish batting." I remember that because I thought it's such a nice way of saying that a batsman was out, to say that he had finished batting. All during the tea interval, Hat was as excited as ever. He tried to get all sorts of people to take all sorts of crazy bets. He ran about waving a dollar note and shouting, "A dollar to a shilling, Headley don't reach double figures." Or, "A dollar, Stolmeyer field the first ball." The umpires were walking out when one of the boys began crying. Hat said, "What you crying for?" The boy cried and mumbled. Hat said, "But what you crying for?" A man shouted, "He want a bottle." Hat turned to the man and said, "$2, 5 Jamaican wickets for this afternoon." The man said, "It's all right by me, if his hurry you is to lose your money." A third man held the stakes. The boy was still crying. Hat said, "But you see how you shaming me in front of all these people? Tell me quick what you want." The boy only cried. Another boy came up to Hat and whispered in his ear. Hat said, "Oh, God, how? Just when they coming out." He made us all stand. He marched us away from the grounds and made us line up against the galvanized iron paling of the oval. He said, "All right now, pee. Pee quick, all of all you." The cricket that afternoon was fantastic. The Jamaican team, which included the great Headley, lost 6 wickets for 31 runs. In the fading light, the Trinidad fast bowler, Tyrrell Johnson, was unplayable, and his success seemed to increase his speed. A fat old woman on our left began screaming at Tyrrell Johnson, and whenever she stopped screaming, she turned to us and said, very quietly, "I know Tyrrell since he was a boy so high. We used to pitch marble together." Then she turned away and began screaming again. Hat collected his bet. This, I discovered presently, was one of Hat's weaknesses, his passion for impossible bets. At the races, particularly, he lost a lot of money, but sometimes he won, and then he made so much he could afford to treat all of us in Miguel Street. I never knew a man who enjoyed life as much as Hat did. He did nothing new or spectacular. In fact, he did practically the same things every day. But he always enjoyed what he did. And every now and then he managed to give a fantastic twist to some very ordinary thing. He was a bit like his dog. This was the tamest Alsatian I have ever known. One of the things I noticed in Miguel Street was the way dogs resembled their owners. George had a surly, mean mongrel. Tony's dog was a terrible savage. Hat's dog was the only Alsatian I knew with a sense of humor. In the first place, it behaved oddly, for an Alsatian. You could make it the happiest dog on earth if you flung things for it to retrieve. One day, in the savannah, I flung a guava into some thick bushes. He couldn't get at the guava, and he whined and complained. He suddenly turned and ran back past me, barking loudly. While I turned to see what was wrong, he ran back to the bushes. I saw nothing strange, and when I looked back, I was just in time to see him taking another guava behind the bushes. I called him, and he rushed up, whining and barking. I said, "Go on, boy. Go on and get the guava." He ran back to the bushes and poked and sniffed a bit, and then dashed behind the bushes to get the guava he had himself placed there. I only wished the beautiful birds Hat collected were as tame as the Alsatian. The macaws and the parrots looked like angry and quarrelsome old women, and they attacked anybody. Sometimes Hat's house became a dangerous place with all these birds around. You would be talking quietly when you would suddenly feel a prick and a tug on your calf, the macaw or the parrot. Hat tried to make us believe they didn't bite him, but I know that they did. Strange that both Hat and Edward became dangerous when they tried meddling with beauty. There was Edward with his painting, and Hat with his sharp-beaked macaws. Hat was always getting into trouble with the police. Nothing serious, though. A little cockfighting here, some gambling there, a little drinking somewhere else, and so on. But it never soured him against the law. In fact, every Christmas, Sergeant Charles, with the postman and the sanitary inspector, came to Hat's place for a drink. Sergeant Charles would say, "Is only a living I have to make, you know, Hat. Nobody ain't have to tell me. I know I ain't going to get any more promotion, but still." Hat would say, "Is all right, Sergeant. None of we don't mind. How are your children these days? How Elijah?" Elijah was a bright boy.
"Elijah?
Oh, I think he could get her exhibition this year. Is all we could do, eh, Hat? All we could do is try. We can't do no more." And they always separated as good friends. But once, Hat got into serious trouble for watering his milk. He said, "The police and them come round asking me how the water get in the milk. As if I know. I know how the water get there. You know I just put the pan in water to keep the milk cool and prevent it from turning. I suppose the pan did have a hole. That's all. A tiny little hole." Edward said, "It better to be frank and tell the magistrate that." Hat said, "Edward, you talking as if Trinidad is England? You ever hear that people tell the truth in Trinidad and get away? In Trinidad, the more you innocent, the more they throw you in jail, and the more bribe you got to hand out. You got to bribe the magistrate. You got to give them fowl, big, big leghorn hen, and you got to give them money. You got to bribe the inspectors. By the time you finish bribing, it would be better if you did take your jail quiet, quiet." Edward said, "It is the truth, but you can't plead guilty. You have to make up some new story." Hat was fined $200, and the magistrate preached a long sermon at him. He was in a real temper when he came back from court. He tore off his tie and coat and said, "It's a damn funny world. You bathe, you put on a clean shirt, you put on tie and you put on jacket, you shine up your shoe, and all for what? Is only to go in front of some stupid magistrate for him to abuse you." It rankled for days. Hat said, "Hitler was right, man. Burn all the law books. Burn all of them up. Make a big pile and set fire to the whole damn thing. Burn them up and watch them burn. Hitler was right, man. I don't know why we fighting him for." Edo said, "You talking a lot of nonsense, you know, Hat." Hat said, "I don't want to talk about it. Don't want to talk about it. Hitler was right. Burn the law books. Burn all of them up. Don't want to talk about it." For 3 months, Hat and Sergeant Charles were not on speaking terms. Sergeant Charles was hurt, and he was always sending messages of goodwill to Hat. One day, he called me and said, "You could be seeing Hat this evening?" I said, "Yes."
"You did see him yesterday?"
"Yes." "How he is?"
"How?
Well, I mean, how he looking?
He looking well? Happy?"
I said, "He looking damn vexed." Sergeant Charles said, "Oh." I said, "All right.
Look, before you go away."
"What?"
"Nothing. No, no, wait, before you go,
tell Hat how for me, you hear?" I told Hat, "Sergeant Charles called me to his house today and began one crying and begging. He keep on asking me to tell you that he not vexed with you, that it wasn't he who tell the police about the milk and the water." Hat said, "Which water? In which milk?" I didn't know what to say. Hat said, "You see the sort of place Trinidad coming now? Somebody say it had water in my milk. Nobody see me put water in the milk, but everybody talking now as if they see me. Everybody talking about the water in the milk." Hat, I saw, was enjoying even this. I always looked upon Hat as a man of settled habits, and it was hard to think of him looking otherwise than he did. I suppose he was 35 when he took me to that cricket match, and 43 when he went to jail. Yet he always looked the same to me. In appearance, as I have said, he was dark brown in complexion, of medium height and medium build. He had a slightly bow-legged walk, and he had flat feet. I was prepared to see him do the same things for the rest of his life. Cricket, football, horse racing. Read the paper in the mornings and afternoons. Sit on the pavement and talk. Get noisily drunk on Christmas Eve and New Year's Eve. He didn't appear to need anything else. He was self-sufficient. And I didn't believe he even needed women. I knew, of course, that he visited certain places in the city from time to time. But I thought he did this more for the vicious thrill than for the women. And then this thing happened. It broke up the Miguel Street Club, and Hat himself was never the same afterwards. In a way, I suppose it was Edward's fault. I don't think any of us realized how much Hat loved Edward, and how heartbroken he was when Edward got married. He couldn't hide his delight when Edward's wife ran away with the American soldier, and he was greatly disappointed when Edward went to Aruba. Once he said, "Everybody grown up, or they leaving?" Another time he said, "I think I was a damn fool not go and work with the Americans, like Edward and so much other people." Eddowes said, "Hat going to town a lot these nights." Boye said, "Well, he is a big man. Why he shouldn't do what he want to do?" Edo said, "It have some men like that. As a matter of fact, it has happened to all man. They getting old and they get frightened, and they want to remain young." I got angry with Edo's because I didn't want to think of Hat in that way. And the worst thing was that I was ashamed because I felt Edo's was right. I said, "Eddowes, why you don't take your dirty mind somewhere else, eh? Why you don't leave all your dirtiness in the rubbish dump?" And then one day, Hat brought home a woman. I felt a little uneasy now in Hat's company. He had become a man with responsibility and obligations, and he could no longer give us all his time and attention. To make matters worse, everybody pretended that the woman wasn't there, even Hat. He never spoke about her, and he behaved as though he wanted us to believe that everything was just the same. She was a pale brown woman, about 30, somewhat plump, and her favorite color was blue. She called herself Dolly. We used to see her looking blankly out of the windows of Hat's house. She never spoke to any of us. In fact, I hardly heard her speak at all, except to call Hat inside. But Boye and Edward were pleased with the changes she brought. Boye said, "Is the first time I remember living with a woman in a house, and it make a lot of difference. It's hard to explain, but I find it nicer." My mother said, "You see how man stupid? Hat see what happened to Edward, and you mean to say that Hat still get herself mixed up with this woman?" Mrs. Morgan and Mrs. Baku saw so little of Dolly, they had little to dislike in her. But they agreed that she was a lazy good-for-nothing. Mrs. Morgan said, "Miss Dolly look like a old madam to me, you hear?" It was easy enough for us to forget that Dolly was there, because Hat continued living as before. We still went to all the sports, and we still sat on the pavement and talked. Whenever Dolly piped, "Hat, you coming?" Hat wouldn't reply. About half an hour later, Dolly would say, "Hat, you coming or you ain't coming?" And Hat would say then, "I coming." I wondered what life was like for Dolly. She was nearly always inside the house, and Hat was nearly always outside. She seemed to spend a great deal of her time at the front window looking out. They were really the queerest couple in the street. They never went out together. We never heard them laughing. They never even quarreled.
Eros said, They like two strangers.
Eros said, Don't mind that, you hear? All you seeing Hot sitting quiet here, but it's different when he get inside. He ain't the same man when he talking with Dolly. He buys you a lot of jewelry, you know.
Eros said, I have a feeling she a little bit like Matilda, you know? The woman in the Calypso. Matilda, 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 you thief my money and go on Venezuela.
Buying jewelry. But what happening to Hat? He behaving as though he is an old man. Women don't want jewelry from a man like Hat. They want something else.
Looking on from the outside, though, one could see only two changes in Hat's household. All the birds were caged, and the Alsatian was chained and miserable. But no one spoke about Dolly to Hat. I suppose the whole business had come as too much of a surprise. What followed was an even bigger surprise, and it was some time before we could get all the details. At first, I noticed Hat was missing, and then I heard rumors. This was the story, as it later came out in court. Dolly had run away from Hat, taking all his gifts, of course. Hat had chased her and found her with another man. There was a great quarrel, the man had fled, and Hat had taken it out on Dolly. Afterwards, the police statement said he had gone in tears to the police station to give himself up. He said, I kill a woman. But Dolly wasn't dead. We received the news as though it was news of a death. We couldn't believe it for a day or two. And then a great hush fell on Miguel Street. No boys and men gathered under the lamppost outside Hat's house, talking about this and that and the other. No one played cricket and disturbed people taking afternoon naps. The club was dead. Cruelly, we forgot all about Dolly and thought only about Hat. We couldn't find it in our hearts to find fault with him. We suffered with him. We saw a changed man in court. He had grown older, and when he smiled at us, he smiled only with his mouth. Still, he put on a show for us, and even while we laughed, we were ready to cry. The prosecutor asked Hat,
Was it a dark night?
Hat said, All night dark.
Hat's lawyer was a short, fat man named Chittaranjan, who wore a smelly brown suit. Chittaranjan began reeling off Portia's speech about mercy, and he would have gone on to the end if the judge hadn't said, All this is interesting and some of it even true, but, Mr. Chittaranjan, you are wasting the court's time. Chittaranjan made a great deal of fuss about the wild passion of love. He said Antony had thrown away an empire for the sake of love, just as Hat had thrown away his self-respect. He said that Hat's crime was really a crime passionnel. In France, he said, and he knew what he was talking about, because he had been to Paris. In France, Hat would have been a hero. Women would have garlanded him.
Edo said, Is this sort of lawyer who does get man hang, you know?
Hat was sentenced to 4 years. We went to Frederick Street Jail to see him. It was a disappointing jail. The walls were light cream and not very high, and I was surprised to see that most of the visitors were very gay. Only a few women wept, but the whole thing was like a party, with people laughing and chatting. Eros, who had put on his best suit for the occasion, held his hat in his hand and looked around. He said to Hat, It don't look too bad here.
Hat said, They're taking me to Carrera next week.
Carrera was a small prison island a few miles from Port of Spain.
Hat said, Don't worry about me. You know me. In 2-3 weeks, I can make them give me something easy to do. Whenever I went to Carenage or Point Cumana for a bathe, I looked across the green water to the island of Carrera, rising high out of the sea with its neat pink buildings. I tried to picture what went on inside those buildings, but my imagination refused to work. I used to think, Hat there, I hear. He know I hear thinking about him? But as the months passed, I became more and more concerned with myself, and I wouldn't think about Hat for weeks on end. It was useless trying to feel ashamed. I had to face the fact that I was no longer missing Hat. From time to time, when my mind was empty, I would stop and think how long it would be before he came out. But I was not really concerned. I was 15 when Hat went to jail, and 18 when he came out. A lot happened in those 3 years. I left school and I began working in the customs. I was no longer a boy. I was a man, earning money. Hat's homecoming fell a little flat. It wasn't only that we boys had grown older. Hat, too, had changed. Some of the brightness had left him, and conversation was hard to make. He visited all the houses he knew, and he spoke about his experiences with great zest. My mother gave him tea. Hat said,
"Is just what I expect. I get friendly with some of the turnkey and them, and you know what happened? I pull 2-3 strings and bam, they make me librarian. They have a big library there, you know. All sort of big book. Is the sort of place Titus Hoyt would like. So much book with nobody to read them."
I offered Hat a cigarette and he took it mechanically. Then he shouted,
"But hey, what is this? You come a big man now. When I leave you wasn't smoking. It was a long time now, though."
I said, "Yes, was a long time. A long time. But it was just 3 years. 3 years in which I had grown up and looked critically at the people around me. I no longer wanted to be like Edo's. He was so weak and thin, and I hadn't realized that he was so small. Titus Hoyt was stupid and boring and not funny at all. Everything had changed. When Hat went to jail, part of me had died." 17. How I left Miguel Street. My mother said, "You getting too wild in this place. I think it's high time you leave."
"And go where? Venezuela?" I said.
"No, not Venezuela. Somewhere else. Because the moment you land in Venezuela, they go throw you in jail. I know you, and I know Venezuela. No, somewhere else."
I said, "All right, you think about it and decide." My mother said,
"I go and talk to Ganesh Pandit about it. He was a friend of your father. But you must go from here. You getting too wild."
I suppose my mother was right. Without really knowing it, I had become a little wild. I was drinking like a fish and doing a lot besides. The drinking started in the customs, where we confiscated liquor on the slightest pretext. At first, the smell of spirits upset me, but I used to say to myself, "You must get over this. Drink it like medicine. Hold your nose and close your eyes." In time, I had become a first-class drinker, and I began suffering from drinker's pride. Then there were the sights of the town Boye and Errol introduced me to. One night, not long after I began working, they took me to a place near Marine Square. We climbed to the first floor and found ourselves in a small, crowded room lit by green bulbs. The green light seemed as thick as jelly. There were many women all about the room, just waiting and looking. A big sign said, "Obscene language forbidden." We had a drink at the bar, a thick, sweet drink. Errol asked me, "Which one of the women you like?" I understood immediately, and I felt disgusted. I ran out of the room and went home, a little sick, a little frightened. I said to myself, you must get over this. Next night, I went to the club again, and again. We made wild parties and took rum and women to Maracas Bay for all-night sessions.
You're getting too wild, my mother said.
I paid her no attention until the time I drank so much in one evening that I remained drunk for 2 whole days afterwards. When I sobered up, I made a vow neither to smoke nor drink again. I said to my mother, it's not my fault, really. It's just Trinidad. What else anybody can do here except drink? About 2 months later, my mother said, you must come with me next week. We're going to see Ganesh Pandit. Ganesh Pandit had given up mysticism for a long time. He had taken to politics and was doing very nicely. He was a minister of something or the other in the government, and I heard people saying that he was in the running for the MBE. We went to his big house in St. Clair, and we found the great man, not dressed in dhoti and kota, as in the mystic days, but in an expensive-looking lounge suit. He received my mother with a good deal of warmth. He said, I'd do what I could do. My mother began to cry. To me, Ganesh said, what do you want to go abroad to study? I said, I don't want to study anything, really. I just want to go away, that's all. Ganesh smiled and said, the government not giving away that sort of scholarship yet. Only ministers could do what you say. No, you have to study something. I said, I never think about it, really. Just let me think a little bit. Ganesh said, all right, you think a little bit. My mother was crying her thanks to Ganesh. I said, I know what I want to study. Engineering. I was thinking about my Uncle Baku. Ganesh laughed and said, what you know about engineering? I said, right now, nothing. But I could put my mind to it. My mother said, why don't you want to take up law? I thought of Chittaranjan and his brown suit, and I said, no, not law. Ganesh said, it have only one scholarship remaining, for drugs. I said, but I don't want to be a druggist. I don't want to put on a white jacket and sell lipstick to women. Ganesh smiled. My mother said, you mustn't mind the boy, Pandit. He will study drugs. And to me, you could study anything if you put your mind to it. Ganesh said, think. It means going to London. It means seeing snow and seeing the Thames and seeing the big parliament. I said, all right, I guess study drugs. My mother said, I don't know what I could do to thank you, Pandit. And crying, she counted out $200 and gave it to Ganesh. She said, I know it ain't much, Pandit, but it is all I have. It's a long time I did saving it up. Ganesh took the money sadly, and he said, you mustn't let that worry you. You must give only what you can afford. My mother kept on crying, and in the end, even Ganesh broke down. When my mother saw this, she dried her tears and said, if you only know, Pandit, how worried I is. I have to find so much money for so much thing these days, and I don't really know how I'm going to make out. Ganesh now stopped crying. My mother began to cry afresh. This went on for a bit until Ganesh gave back $100 to my mother. He was sobbing and shaking, and he said, take this and buy some good clothes for the boy. I said, Pandit, you was a good man. This affected him strongly. He said, is when you come back from England with all sort of certificate and paper, a big man and a big druggist? Is then I come round and ask for what you owe me. I told Hat I was going away. Hat said, what for?
Laboring?
I said, the government give me a scholarship to study drugs. He said,
is you who wangled that?
I said, not me, my mother. Edo said,
it's a good thing. A druggist fella I know, picking up rubbish for him for years now. This fella rich like anything, man. The man just rolling in money.
The news got to Elias, and he took it badly. He came to the gate one evening and shouted,
bribe, bribe, is all you could do. Bribe.
My mother shouted back, the only people who does complain about bribe is those who too damn poor to have anything to bribe with. In about a month, everything was fixed for my departure. The Trinidad government wrote to the British Consul in New York about me. The British Consul got to know about me. The Americans gave me a visa after making me swear that I wouldn't overthrow their government by armed force. The night before I left, my mother gave a little party. It was something like a wake. People came in looking sad and telling me how much they were going to miss me. And then they forgot about me and attended to the serious business of eating and drinking. Laura kissed me on the cheek and gave me a medallion of St. Christopher. She asked me to wear it around my neck. I promised that I would, and I put the medallion in my pocket. I don't know what happened to it. Mrs. Baku gave me a sixpenny piece, which she said she had had specially consecrated. It didn't look different from other sixpenny pieces, and I suppose I spent it. Titus Hoyt forgave me everything, and brought me volume 2 of the Everyman edition of Tennyson. Eros gave me a wallet which he swore was practically new. Boye and Errol gave me nothing. Hat gave me a carton of cigarettes. He said, I know you say you ain't smoking again, but take this, just in case you change your mind. The result was that I began smoking again. Uncle Baku spent the night fixing the van which was to take me to the airport next morning. From time to time I ran out and begged him to take it easy. He said he thought the carburetor was playing the fool. Next morning, Baku got up early and was at it again. We had planned to leave at 8, but at 10:02, Baku was still tinkering. My mother was in a panic, and Mrs. Baku was growing impatient. Baku was underneath the car, whistling a couplet from the Ramayana. He came out, laughed, and said, you getting frightened, eh? Presently, we were all ready. Baku had done little damage to the engine, and it still worked. My bags were taken to the van, and I was ready to leave the house for the last time. My mother said, wait. She placed a brass jar of milk in the middle of the gateway. I cannot understand, even now, how it happened. The gateway was wide, big enough for a car, and the jar, about 4 inches wide, was in the middle. I thought I was walking at the edge of the gateway, far away from the jar, and yet I kicked the jar over. My mother's face fell. I said, is a bad sign? She didn't answer. Baku was blowing the horn. We got into the van and Baku drove away, down Miguel Street and up Wrightson Road to South Quay. I didn't look out of the windows. My mother was crying. She said, I know I'm not going to ever see you in Miguel Street again. I said, why? Because I knocked the milk down? She didn't reply, still crying for the spilt milk. Only when we had left Port of Spain and the suburbs, I looked outside. It was a clear, hot day. Men and women were working in rice fields. Some children were bathing under a standpipe at the side of the road. We got to Piaco in good time, and at this stage I began wishing I had never got the scholarship. The airport lounge frightened me. Fat Americans were drinking strange drinks at the bar. American women, wearing haughty sunglasses, raised their voices whenever they spoke. They all looked too rich, too comfortable. Then the news came, in Spanish and English. Flight 206 had been delayed for 6 hours. I said to my mother, "Let me go back to Port of Spain." I had to be with those people in the lounge soon anyway, and I wanted to put off the moment. And back in Miguel Street, the first person I saw was Hat. He was strolling flat-footedly back from the cafe with a paper under his arm. I waved and shouted at him. All he said was, "I thought you was in the air by this time." I was disappointed, not only by Hat's cool reception, disappointed because although I had been away, destined to be gone for good, everything was going on just as before, with nothing to indicate my absence. I looked at the overturned brass jar in the gateway, and I said to my mother, "So this mean I was never going to come back here, eh?" She laughed and looked happy. So I had my last lunch at home, with my mother and Uncle Baku and his wife. Then back along the hot road to Piaco, where the plane was waiting. I recognized one of the customs officers, and he didn't check my baggage. The announcement came, a cold, casual thing. I embraced my mother. I said to Baku, "Uncle Bak, I didn't want to tell you before, but I think I hear your tappet knocking." His eyes shone. I left them all and walked briskly toward the aeroplane, not looking back, looking only at my shadow before me, a dancing dwarf on the tarmac. This concludes the reading of Miguel Street by V.S. Naipaul. Copyright 1959, renewed 1987 by V.S. Naipaul. This book was read by Ron Butler. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Wiley Agency, LLC, and was produced in 2018 by Blackstone Publishing, which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Publishing. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.